Let me just explain what I hope to do with the class. And my thought is today is sort of introduction. And if anybody decides, you know what, not for me, not this year, that's great. This is, I invited everyone that's here. But if you decide, maybe I need to put it off, because I'll probably do this every other year, every third year, or something like that. So let me explain what I hope to accomplish in the year, or my goals for the year. And then we'll get into some introductory material. The first thing is just, I'm 52, you know, say I got 15 good productive years. I think I need to spend my last years raising up more leaders and creating the aspiration for leadership. So, you know, Gus is here. I think Charles is going to come. Those are younger guys. Basically, anybody whose life is just going fine, or, you know, people that you think of over the years, I think we need to encourage the aspiration to become an ordained leader of some kind. So that's one thing, is just let's encourage the aspiration, as Paul says. The other thing is I want to discuss authority. Part of the point of the class is discussing biblical authority and what it is. And so toward that end, we're going to study Deuteronomy, but there's only one required text, and it's this. And I can send this out. It's Authority by Jonathan Lehman. And I want to have a common understanding of authority among us. We all will bear authority in some way, but there's different kinds of authority. There's the authority of a parent, and that's different from the authority of a husband. And it would be good if we all understood how that's different. The authority of a coach, the authority of a pastor, the authority of a CEO. So this is a fantastic text on the nature of authority, a biblical definition for it, how it works in various spheres. And I would like us all to have kind of a common understanding of authority. There's a lot of different understandings of authority in Christian circles, and I would like us all to be on the same page. A third goal would be deepening Bible study skills. So, like I said, one of the big things we're going to do for the year is study Deuteronomy. And taking a year-long dive in it, reading it hopefully somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 times will deepen everyone and will deepen in skills of understanding the Bible. And I'll in a little bit explain why I picked Deuteronomy. And then finally, I hope probably come November or so, around fast time, we'll probably have a few ordinations, whether of a deacon or an elder, I'm not sure. But we'll probably have a few ordinations. So that's the big goal. And again, I imagine we'll do this from here on out. I'll do this in a semi-regular basis. So if you decide to dive in and do the class, here's the responsibilities that come with the class. Like I said, multiple readings of Deuteronomy through the year. I think it takes anywhere, depending on your reading speed, from an hour and a half to 2.5 hours to read Deuteronomy. So break that up how you will. You could, you know, 30 minutes a day, or you could, on a Saturday, get up early and plow through. Toward that end, I don't have one with me. Kelly does. I kind of encourage a copy of a journaling version of Deuteronomy. There's that one, which is ESV. There's a Legacy Standard version. And that would just allow you to have a year's worth of notes in the book of Deuteronomy. And imagine, you know, one of your kids, like, inheriting that or something like that, among other things, is kind of a neat heirloom. So one would be multiple readings of Deuteronomy in the year. Again, multiple translations, but a deep familiarity with that. As I said, reading of this book by Lehman. And then I'd like everybody to write a paper on a topic of your choice from Deuteronomy. And I imagine that will take shape here in the spring, and then people could hammer that out in the fall. And I don't have a lot of parameters in mind just yet, other than it would be a study that would be something near and dear to your heart, on a theme that's near and dear to your heart in Deuteronomy, that you would carry forward. So that's goals, responsibilities. Any questions before I get into Deuteronomy itself. Did I send out dates for the... did I send out dates? Yeah, about two, sometimes three times a month. And I've got date. I'll send the dates out. I've got them through May. We may take a break in the summer or just meet fewer times in the summer. Summer's crazy. Then we'll pick back up in the fall. Anything? Any other questions? All right, well, let me talk about Deuteronomy and why Deuteronomy. Of course, Deuteronomy is the fifth of the books of the Pentateuch. It's a unique book in that one translation or the name in English that we have, Deuteronomy, means second law or repetition of the law. And if you really pay attention and compare between Exodus and Deuteronomy, which a lot of us don't, right, because it's just all these obscure laws and it's hard to pay attention to that. But if you compare between them, there's some differences. And the question is, why are those differences? The context of Deuteronomy, the context of Exodus, speaks to a pattern I think you see in the Bible. So Moses can't handle all the people. And Jethro, his father-in-law, says, you know, you need to appoint guys under you who can support this. And then in the New Testament, when the church has grown in Acts chapter 7, there's this burden and the leadership of the church can't handle the growth of the church. And they say, hey, let's appoint some guys who can carry this. So I think you see an Old Testament, New Testament pattern of God blesses the church, it grows, and the leadership says, man, we need more leaders. We need more people who are willing to step up and carry this weight. So it's a deeply biblical pattern. A couple other reasons why I think Deuteronomy is significant. In our current context today in America, we have tons of debates on issues of justice. So immigration, race relations, employee pay, minimum wage, self-defense. Deuteronomy addresses all of those things. And sometimes I think we come from our current political instincts, but maybe not as much from a deep understanding of biblical teaching related to these things. So there's all kinds of ways in which I think we'll learn and have a better sense for justice and how it works in various spheres, because I think a lot of that is in Deuteronomy. A third thing is the importance of the law. So again, as Christians, we know we're not under the law. However, it's important to note, both Paul and Jesus say, we're not under the law, but we fulfill the law. So in Romans chapter 8, Paul says, those who have been given the Spirit fulfill the law. We're not under the law. And Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, don't think I've come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. But we can't fulfill a law that we don't understand. Having a deeper understanding of the logic of the law will make us better equipped with the help of the Spirit to fulfill the law. Not only that, but I think we have maybe a bad understanding of not being under the law. Sometimes I think we think, oh yeah, Old Testament, all those rules, phew, glad we're not under all those rules. But the life they were sketching is what we're called to fulfill. So I think we have this sort of anti-law impulse, and I don't think it's a biblical impulse. Again, we're called to fulfill it, and we need to understand it in order to fulfill it. Deuteronomy is one of the most commonly quoted books in the New Testament, somewhere probably third to Isaiah and Psalms. So it's deeply significant in the New Testament. And one last thing I'll mention that is significant is in American history, in American political history, a lot of people point out that our political founders are... the founding documents are inspired by Enlightenment thinkers like Locke and others, right? And that it was Enlightenment political theorists that sort of shape our political structure. But there's a lot of Jewish scholars that are making the argument, actually, it was Protestants in the 16th century who were beginning to study Hebrew, who went back to, in particular, Deuteronomy, and Deuteronomy deeply shaped their understanding of politics and therefore the political theory that went into shaping the founders. We'll get into some examples of this, but I'll just give a brief example. In the section of Deuteronomy that deals with political leaders, or leaders, everything from kings to judges to priests to others, you see, there's this division of powers, and there's this limit on the powers, and there's an appellate process among judges where they have appeals where they can bring it up to Moses or other leaders, the priests. So you see a lot of the principles that are in the Constitution, division of power, sort of term limits or limits on power. So you can see ways in which, even in our own political history, it's deeply influenced by the Bible, in particular Deuteronomy. So I think we can have a better understanding of our origins. So what is Deuteronomy? So remember the context. Deuteronomy, end of the time in the wilderness, end of the wilderness generation. Moses is leading them to the promised land. They're in Moab, across from entrance into the land on the Jordan River. And it's Moses' sermons to Israel before he dies and before they go into the promised land. And the whole book is a covenant renewal ceremony. And this is important because I think communion, or actually every church service, is a covenant renewal ceremony. All right? It is a new covenant renewal ceremony, but we need to understand the old covenant ceremony. So it's a renewal ceremony because the first cutting of the covenant was at Sinai with the Ten Commandments. And this is the next generation, and Moses is reiterating the covenant to them. And he's actually following something that existed in antiquity. So we know covenants existed. They call them suzerainty treaties. And basically what would happen in these covenants is you would have some lesser king who needed help, protection, whatever, and he would appeal to a greater power, and they would cut a covenant between themselves. And those covenants had a very particular structure that you see in the book of Deuteronomy. And it's God is, as it were, appropriating something in the culture around them and using it for his own purposes. Let me just go through what you see in these ancient covenants. There's always a preamble. Sort of the context, the people involved, the place and time. Then there's a historical prologue, a detailing of how this covenant came about. And then there's the stipulations of the covenant, the commitments of all parties involved in the covenant. And then a deposition, meaning where is the covenant going to be installed and how will it be consulted? Then five is sanctions. In other words, if you break the covenant, this is what will happen to you. And then witnesses. All right? So this is the outline of Deuteronomy. Okay? And 1 through 15, Moses sort of gives the context, right? Or the narration gives the context. They're on the plains of Moab. They're getting ready to enter into the promised land. Then you get the historical prologue where Moses tells the story of how Israel got where they are, starting at Sinai. And when we get to that, it'll be interesting, because if you were Moses at that point and you were going to reiterate the history, what details would you tell? It's different, I think, than what Moses actually tells. He pulls out different things. Among other things, and this is one of the reasons we're using it, is he reiterates the part about, I couldn't carry you, so we appointed leaders. All right. There's an argument among some commentators that Deuteronomy is a guidebook for leadership. All right. So this is another reason we're using it. Stipulations. In other words, what should you do if you're a part of this covenant? So what's interesting about that is in chapter 5 of Deuteronomy, we get the reiteration of the 10 commandments, the 10 words. And then 5 through 11, we get the Shema, Hear, O Israel, the sort of the greatest commandment. And then in 12 through 26, we get this central section that bewilders a lot of people because it seems like a random collection of obscure laws that don't apply anymore, right? Things like putting rails on your roof, what to do with blood, etc. But this follows the section on stipulations, and I'll explain what I think is going on in this section in a little bit. Deposition and regular reading. So the law was supposed to be written on large stones. The law was placed in the ark, and there was a provision that the law would be read publicly every 7 years, right? as a way to remind everybody of what the law said and what the law's commitments were. And then finally, sanctions. Remember that whole ceremony? They get one group of guys, they go up on one mountain, and another group of guys, they go up on the other mountain, and they read the blessings and the curses, right? Here's the blessings that come with covenant obedience. Here's the curses that come with covenant disobedience. And by the way, this should remind everybody of the Sermon on the Mount, right? I won't give all the details, but Jesus goes up, he exposits the law, the fulfillment of the law, and at the end of it, what does he do? He says, well, there's a house built on the sand, and there's a house built on the rock. All right, covenant blessings, covenant curses, or switch that. And then finally, witnesses. Heaven and earth are the witnesses. And then it's super interesting, and we don't do it much. Maybe I'll find a version of this song that we could sing. Moses sings a song. The last thing he does is he sings a song, and he says, I want you to teach this to everybody. Because the song is sort of a wrap-up of everything he has to say there. So it's a covenant ceremony. Deuteronomy is also, and this is why I think it's different and why it's important for us. The differences between the laws in Exodus and the laws in Deuteronomy can be explained by the laws in Exodus were given to a nomadic people. They're wandering around in the wilderness. But they're getting ready to settle in the land, and God wants the land to be a land of blessing. He wants it to be a land of life. And the changes in the law that you see in Deuteronomy can be explained by the heart of the law, the Ten Commandments, being applied and expounded and meditated upon in a new context. Does that make sense? I think that's what Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount, and that's what God's people are always called to do. We have a new context, new situations that the law doesn't outline, like a pandemic, a worldwide pandemic or whatever. There's new situations, and God's people need to be able to understand the logic of God's law to be able to apply it to new contexts. And so it's giving us an example of doing that in Deuteronomy that can be instructive for us in our context. While I have this handout, or while you have this handout, let me mention some other structural things. So that second issue, the verbal markers for structure, if you go through, it'll have this repeated phrase, something like, these are the words, this is the law, these are the statutes, etc. And those are a good clue as to the structure. And if you'll note, they kind of correspond to what's going on up above. All right, so that's another just, if you're taking notes as you read, that's another way to understand it. And then in that last section, let me explain this, because I do think this is the deep logic of Exodus. So as I said, commentators for a long time have been like, man, right in the middle of it, it's just weird. I mean, we get the beginning, we get the end, but right in the middle, it's just the laws, and they're all random, and it doesn't make sense, their structure, what's going on there. I think the most persuasive argument is that they're actually a meditative unpacking of the Ten Commandments. In other words, you have the commandment, thou shalt not kill. I think if you look, the sixth word is thou shalt not kill. And item six, I think that's section 19 through 22, is talking about warfare. So it's not just thou shalt not kill, but where is killing appropriate and in what contexts? How do you deal with martial violence when it's necessary? Does that make sense? So you get this big sort of broad category, killing, and then you get this unpacking of what that should look like or might look like in various contexts. Does that make sense? So that sexual central section, I think, actually does have a logic. Another example, I think this falls under that section, it has the law about the roof and the rail on the roof. Well, that's under the thou shalt not kill section. Does that make sense? And those are meant to be examples that allow you to say, all right, we're a people of life, and we should have this philosophy of life and preserving life. So how in my new context do I do things like make sure people don't get hurt as far as it's in my power to make sure that happens? When is, again, physical violence appropriate and necessary? So this is one outline for how people understand how that works. Okay, so notice the section with the Shema is, thou shalt have no other gods before me. All right, and you know, the greatest, that sort of sums up the greatest commandment. The second word section has a lot to do with idols and issues related to worship. The third word, this is interesting. And again, when you read it, it'll maybe be hard to make this fit. There's food prohibitions there. How does that have to do with not taking the Lord's name in vain? There's them being a holy people. How does that have to do with not taking the Lord's name in vain? The Sabbath. I think this gives a great, deep understanding of the Sabbath, because in that Sabbath section, there's things like laws about release after the seventh year for a slave. There's things about debt cancellation. Those are Sabbath principles that are being applied economically and in various ways. So does that make sense? So as you read, try the structure out. Some other people have like a different outline, or the breaks fall in different places. But if you keep in mind, this central section is unpacking the 10 words. What word maybe is being addressed here? And how does that work? Does that make sense? All right, a few more things. Let me mention a couple of keywords, actually three keywords in Deuteronomy that are crucial. And the first one is Shema. one of the ways to discern major themes in a book is how frequently a word occurs. This word occurs 92 times in Deuteronomy. That is an enormous concentration when you compare it with other books. Shema. For our purposes, you can spell it S-H-E-M-A, right? So 92 times. I think you've heard me say before that this word doesn't mean obey in the strict sense of just shut up and do it. All right, it doesn't mean that. In fact, when Hebrew was revived as a language, it had been just a language of rabbis for centuries, but when it was revived as a living language, and they needed a word in the military for shut up and do what I say, they had to borrow a word from Arabic. Because this word Shema doesn't mean shut up and do what I say. It means pay attention, listen, meditate upon, understand the logic of. It means all these things, and of course, so that you can enact it. But the point is, God is not interested in just shut up and do what I say. Particularly with leaders, he's interested in his people understanding God's heart and the logic of his ways, so that they know how to apply it in new situations. And just more broadly, consider how much hearing. I said this last night at the beginning of the service. We are an addressed people. Think about how important hearing is for the people of God. The world is made by God's word. Adam, after he rebels, God does what? He calls him. The Ten Commandments are called the Ten Words. And I think I've mentioned this before, but I'll mention it here. If you count, there's 10 sort of "and God said" in the Genesis 1 account, and there's 10 words. So God creates the world in 10 words, and he recreates us in 10 words. The point is, God's word is creative. We think of laws as limiting, and this is another way we need to revise our understanding of law. We think of laws as limits. But God's address, his teaching, his words, is creative. It brings forth new life, new structures, new possibilities. And then, of course, Jesus is called the Word. All right, more than, there's a lot you could go into here. This is why there's a prohibition against images that are made of God. We are first and foremost an addressed people, a people who are meant to have an open ear. And a heart that meditates and chews on God's law. Again, consider Psalm 1, the blessed man that meditates on God's word day and night. Words and address are personal, right? In a way that sight is not as personal. Jesus says, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit's, or what, hear what I'm saying, and in Revelation, hear what the Spirit says to the church. All right, so I would say that is the sort of deepest theme of Deuteronomy, is to the leaders of the people of God, hear, meditate, pay attention, study, muse upon, so that you can enact. All right, it speaks to our posture towards the Word. All right, another recurring word, love. And I don't think we usually think Deuteronomy, yeah, love. In fact, in the rest of the Pentateuch, in the first four books of Moses, love is primarily, exclusively, mentioned between humans, right? It's not mentioned between the people and God. But for the first time, or in a very significant, more significant way, in Deuteronomy, we're enjoined to love God. And God speaks of His love for His people. So again, the greatest commandment, Deuteronomy 6, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. So now God applies this language of love to Him and His people. I have loved you. I want your love in return. And this is why I think the Bible repeatedly uses the image of God as a husband to Israel and Israel's failed love. I think it also speaks to why songs about jilted love are so popular. It's like a deep logic of the way history works. God is the jilted lover, calling His people back to Him. Even God's anger is offended love, right? If you consider it in that context, God's anger is not an inappropriate jealousy, but offended love. Israel, you're my bride. I have redeemed you. So the two greatest commandments, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor. By the time we get to the New Testament, if you're paying attention to this theme of love, in fact, I want to stress this. In Deuteronomy, I can't remember how many times, pay attention when you read it to how many times, love the stranger. All right? And the logic is, you were strangers in Egypt, and you know how that went for you. So when there are strangers in your midst, you need to love them. So that when we get to the New Testament and Jesus teaches love your enemy, that shouldn't be that surprising given the precedence of love in the Old Testament. Does that make sense? And the emphasis on loving the stranger. Okay, lastly, and really I'm wrapping up. This is shorter than I thought it would be, so we can have a little time of discussion here at the end. The last word that occurs a lot, not quite as much as the others, but it's notable in its thematic repetition, is joy. So listening, love, and joy. So joy occurs a lot. And in particular, I would encourage you to pay attention to the three festivals. So Israel is commanded to have three pilgrim festivals. It's at the beginning of the harvest, at the middle of the harvest, and at the end of the harvest. And for those three festivals, they go to Jerusalem and they spend a whole week. And notice what it says. It says, if you live far away and you can't bring your animals for the sacrifice, sell them, get money, come to Jerusalem, buy whatever your heart desires, whether meat or drink or whatever, and rejoice before the Lord. All right? Again, I don't think we think Deuteronomy joy, but I want you to notice Deuteronomy joy. The festive joy of the people of God. Rejoicing in His presence, rejoicing with blessings. I would call these festivals three week-long versions of Thanksgiving or Christmas or Easter. Right? Where Thanksgiving is about a day of feasting. These are week-long, weeks of feasting and celebration in God's presence. Where, notice, nobody's to be left out. You're going to have a bunch because God blesses you and you'll have plenty to share with everybody. Everybody is rejoicing in God's presence. So I think you can, if you keep this in mind, if you've read The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings, in The Hobbit, how many people have not read The Hobbit? Okay, in The Hobbit, at the end, the hobbits are pretty simple. They don't like big adventures. They don't like, you know, big politics. They just like to garden and good food and good song. And one of the dwarves, he's really greedy and political, and he's gotten into a big war, and he's on his deathbed, and he's talking to Bilbo the Hobbit, and he says, "If more of us valued food and cheer and song above hoarded gold, it would be a merrier world." If you can sort of hear that at the heart of God's commandments to rejoice, I think you'll pick up on this undertone of joy that's in Deuteronomy.